Bruce Johnson, and this is the fourth of five sessions on C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, this marvelous story here. You will recall, for a brief introduction and transition, when I was asked to do something in the area of literature for our theme, On Earth as It Is in Heaven, C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce, occurred to me. For a whole number of reasons, which I hope has become obvious to those of you who have been a part of the class so far, and hopefully will become obvious for those who are here today for the first time. And last session is 10:45 tomorrow morning. What became evident to me as I looked at what else was happening in the teaching instructions here at Holden this week, at any rate, and what was evident to me as I think about the life that we have in general, as either Christian people, or if you're here a non-Christian, the sort of way we look at things in general, it's easier to give attention to this prepositional phrase in our theme, on earth, than it is to the rest of it, as it is in heaven. It's harder to get hold of that the whole thing behind this petition of the Lord's Prayer is that it's based on as it is in heaven. Now, one of the themes that comes through from Lewis, and it'll come through powerfully in the portion we'll read today, is the kind of twofold meaning of this phrase, as it is in heaven. On one level, heaven is where God's will is done. Translate that. If you're not interested in doing God's will, you're probably not interested in heaven. Now, we assume we're all interested in heaven. But it's the paucity of our imagination, the scantiness of our imagination, that limits the concept of heaven. There's a rich tradition, reaching way back into ancient literature, on up into Bible onset, that would broaden out our concept of literature, broaden out our concept of what heaven is through literature, and C.S. Lewis is one of those that attempts to do so, so we get a larger picture of what it means to do as it is in heaven. But it also means we are to do on earth as God's will is done in heaven. That means we have to have some sense of what it means that God's will is done in heaven. And this is one of the books that does that. Now, most of you will also recognize immediately that the other, in history, most marvelous way we have of getting hold of what it means to do God's will in heaven is in the parables. Thanks to Harold Burr, C.S. Lewis keeps showing up all over the place. And he brought along a book that any of you are interested in Narnia, not just because it happens to be the theme of our children's center here. This is the best thing I've come across. I had seen it on bookshelves before, but it's the first time I've actually seen a copy he'd brought along. It's an annotation, an illustrated guide to Narnia. And the introduction to this reminded me, I'd forgotten, so I want to say thanks, Harold, for bringing the book and sharing it with you. A sub-theme here, that what is the purpose of story? If this doesn't grab you, then just let it be and we'll get on in the rest of it. It grabbed me, and maybe it'll have some value to you. A story sets before our imagination something that has baffled the intellect. Okay? Or, another way to put it, we need both of these. Reason is to the mind as story is to the imagination. And our human mind needs reason, but our imagination needs story. Or to put it slightly a different way, mind seeks truth and imagination seeks meaning. Now, we could spend the whole rest of this session talking about all of the interrelationships of this. We're not going to. If that grabs you, fine. Because we were kind of struggling yesterday. What was the meaning of that story? But that's the whole point. You want to get into the meaning behind it. You want to have some sense of what's this story telling us. Is it telling us something that appeals to our soul? Appeals to our sense of what it is that your rule come, your will be done on earth as in heaven. Okay, that's background. The rest of this stuff at the bottom that we'll get to later. Now, one of the critiques, and I need to ask for a quick poll here, that I got from the session yesterday was that I did not give enough introduction beforehand to the nature of the story. so that you had some sense of what we were getting into as we read the episode yesterday. Others said, no, it's much more fun to discover it as you get into it and discover some of the meaning behind it. Now, you may have no preference, and if so, don't vote. But I'm just going to do a quick poll, because I can give you about a 2-minute introduction of this story that for some of you, I'd have to say, probably will help you understand what it is we're going to read better up front. The rest of you will probably enjoy discovering it as we get into it and hear the story. Okay, I'm going to take a quick poll, show of hands. Which of you would rather, we'll do the first one first, have a two to three minute preface before we get into the story? Okay, which of you would just prefer to get right into it? Oh, amazing, very strong preference to have the preface. Okay, I could not have predicted that. But that's what the critique was from last night. So that's what we'll go ahead and get into then. And it'll probably help the reading for all of us. Okay, and as a part of that, those of you who have been here before knows that this book is an effort to tell by story, by fantasy, by imagination, something to us of heaven and hell. And the device that C.S. Lewis uses, first of all, the first two chapters are about hell, an imaginary hell. And his hell is the opposite of fire and brimstone. His hell is a gray, dreary, lonely place. Gray and dreary and lonely. Lonely because the population of hell, they can't stand each other. And so they keep moving farther and farther away. And when anybody intrudes on somebody else's space, they both move farther away. It's incredible imagery, as you'll find out if you enjoy this kind of story imagery of what hell is like. Gray, dismal, and lonely. Well, the device, story device that C.S. Lewis uses, it actually is a great story tradition called this refrigerium, which is, like our word refrigerator, it's a cooling device. Anyway, it's a bus trip that every once in a while a bus will come through hell and take anybody who wants to heaven for a trip to see what it's like. And the rest of the book is the unfolding of the encounters of the people in this particular bus trip who begin to encounter heaven. And what do they encounter? But they begin to encounter some bright people or solid people. And one of the sub-themes is that you have to learn to be able to walk in heaven. And if you're insubstantial, like these ghosts who have been in hell, you can see right through them. They're like smoke. Once they get to heaven, they have to be able to learn to walk in heaven. How do they begin to learn and walk in heaven is by being met by bright people or solid people who come to meet them to welcome them to heaven. Okay? And in each case, the beauty of this type of storytelling, in each case is it's someone who was central to their life on earth. Central. And that person comes to welcome them. And that's the general thing that we'll get into in this story now today. And we're going to begin on page, there's a couple other things I'm going to say about this particular one, but so you know, we're going to begin on page, right after we finish, 106 is where we're going to begin, chapter 12. Those of you who have the Xerox copies, it's page 12. Do any of you want to follow the text that aren't near one? Raise your hand, and then I'll make sure you get near a text if you wish to follow. And we're going to need some readers today. I'm going to rely heavily on Bob because he's a... I'm actually going to ask him to take two roles, but he doesn't know that yet. He just found that out.
Thank you.
You're welcome. After you read Burns last night, I knew you could do more than one role. So you might begin thinking of some of you like to volunteer to do it. It's fun to do. Okay. On this particular trip, on this particular incident within the trip, there is a lady. You may remember Barb Rossing at the very beginning asked about whether C.S. Lewis was too male-oriented, and I said, hang on, the final story, one of the most beautiful ones, is very clearly shows that he has a strong understanding of the role, place of the female in the male-female fullness of humanity. So it's a lady who has died in a nursing home. This lady had a husband who tried to manipulate the nature of the relationship between the two of them, was always trying to get her pity. Okay? Now he thought that he was, what, the martyr? He thought that he was the one who never got enough of her love. Okay? He didn't understand, therefore, why he ends up in hell. She, when he gets off the bus, she comes to welcome him. And what you'll see is, to me, one of the most astoundingly creative devices that I've seen, not only to understand all the themes we're dealing with, but just to understand human psychology. The husband shows up as two characters. Two characters. You'll need to know this because we wanted to preface. There's two characters, both of whom are the one husband. But it's the two kind of opposing mentalities in the husband's psyche that are being portrayed. And there's a tragedian, or a person who was sort of a ham tragic actor, who's one of the characters, and the other is a dwarf. Okay? And you'll see the interplay between the tragedian and the dwarf, both of whom are the dead husband who was in hell, being met by the wife who is in heaven, come to welcome and ask if the husband is really ready now, after all this time, to enter into heaven. That's the background for the story, and that's what's happening. So keep that in mind as we read through that story, and see it both for the interplay of human nature, but also for, as is always the case in the interplay in human nature, what's happening in the divine-human relationship, and the relationship, thus, between heaven and hell. Okay, now, there's a very small male part that is where C.S. Lewis is the I person in this, wherever something says I. So I need one volunteer to read C.S. Lewis, a male part. It's a very simple part. Who'd like to do that? Okay, you got it. Wherever it's C.S. Lewis, you are. Nairn, you're going to do George MacDonald. One quick word about George MacDonald. It showed up about 4 or 5 chapters ago. George MacDonald is the spiritual mentor, actually in life, was a spiritual mentor for C.S. Lewis. And he makes of George MacDonald the bright or solid person who comes to welcome C.S. Lewis, who has been in hell, and asks George MacDonald all these questions. George MacDonald was a preacher, a dissenting preacher in the Church of Scotland, and just had a powerful influence on a number of people at the end of the last century. If you want to know more about George MacDonald, I'd be delighted to talk to you about it. But Nairn, because he's Scottish, will read that. Nairn, will you also read the role of the tragedian? That would be very helpful, I think, if you could do that. Then we'll need one lady who wants to read the role of the lady, and then one man to read the dwarf role. What lady? Some of you know some of this and know it can be fun. Who would like to read the role of the lady? Any one of you? I'll just pick somebody. Do some of you enjoy doing it? Or are all of you ladies here today shy? Before we had people who really enjoyed it. You don't have to have any practice at it. What? You want to? You got it. You're on. Who wants to do the dwarf? I need a male role to do the dwarf part of the tragedian dwarf relationship. You are?
I can do the dwarf.
You do the dwarf. Now, what's important to you, for both of you, dwarf and tragedian, there's two places in the text where, in a remarkable dramatic device that C.S. Lewis is, you're actually reading it together. So when it gets to those pages there with Bob, you have to start reading together at that point.
May I say that the young lady that did such a good job last time, didn't you read before?
Yeah, I read before.
Maybe we can have her because she did such a nice job. Rather than me.
Well, I thought you volunteered to do the lady.
Volunteer. Okay, great. Well, that's fine.
You volunteered. No, that's fine.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah, no, you're on. That's great. Okay, page 106. Now, the previous chapter had concluded in saying, after this great story of how we saw, just a word of the last chapter, very quickly, 30 seconds, It was a story of a man who comes up, a ghost comes into heaven, has a lizard on his back. And the bright spirit that comes to meet him wants to take the lizard away, and the person resists, and finally the person consents to have the lizard torn off. In a marvelous turn of the story, the lizard represents lust. Lust is transformed into the most beautiful of all kind of love, and the person enters into heaven, willing to let lust be torn from him, transformed into a new kind of love. And at the end, he says, page 105, "But is there another river, sir?" he asks. And then begins chapter 12. "The reason why I asked if there was another river was this. All down one long aisle of the forest, the undersides of the leafy branches had begun to tremble with dancing light. And on earth, I knew nothing so likely to produce this appearance as the reflected light cast upward by moving water. A few moments later, I realized my mistake. Some kind of procession was approaching us, and the light came from the persons who composed it." Beautiful imagery. "First came the bright spirits, not the spirits of men who danced and scattered flowers, soundlessly falling, lightly drifting flowers, though by standards of the ghost world, each petal would have weighed 100 weight and their fall would have been like the crashing of a boulder." You need to know the background of the story to know all the meaning of that, but we won't go into it now. "Then on the left and right, at each side of the forest avenue, came youthful shapes, boys one upon one hand and girls upon the other. If I could remember," beautiful commentary on the Mozart last night here, by the way, "if I could remember their singing and write down the notes, no man who read that score would ever grow sick or old. Between them went musicians, and after these a lady in whose honor all this procession was being done. I cannot now remember whether she was naked or clothed. If she were naked, then it must have been the almost visible penumbra of her courtesy and joy, which produces in my memory the illusion of a great and shining train that followed her across the happy grass. If she were clothed, then the illusion of nakedness is doubtless due to the clarity with which her inmost spirit shone through the clothes. For clothes in that country are not a disguise. The spiritual body lives along each thread and turns them into living organs. A robe or crown is there as much as one of the wearer's features as a lip or an eye. But I have forgotten, and only partly do I remember the unbearable beauty of her face." C.S. Lewis now.
"Is it? Is it?"
I whispered to my guide.
"Not at all. It's someone you'll never have heard of. Her name on earth was Sarah Smith, and she lived at Golders Green."
"She seems to be, well, a person of particular importance."
"Aye, she's one of the great ones. You've heard that fame in this country and fame on earth are two quite different things."
"And who are these gigantic people? Look! They're like emeralds who are dancing and throwing flowers before her."
"Haven't you read your Milton? 1,000 liveried angels lackey her."
"And who are all these young men and women on each side?"
"They're her sons and daughters."
"She must have had a very large family, sir."
"Every young man or boy that met her became her son. Even if it was only the boy that brought the meat to her back door, every girl that met her was her daughter."
"Isn't that a bit hard on their own parents?"
"No. There are those that steal other people's children. But her motherhood was of a different kind. Those on whom it fell went back to their natural parents, loving them more. Few men looked on her without becoming, in a certain fashion, her lovers. But it was the kind of love that made them not less true, but truer to their own wives."
"And how, but hello? What are all these animals? A cat, two cats, and dozens of cats. And all those dogs, why, I can't count them. And the birds and the horses."
"They are our beasts."
"Did she keep a sort of zoo? I mean, this is a bit too much."
"Every beast and bird that came near her had its place in her love. In her they became themselves. And now the abundance of life she has in Christ from the Father flows over into them."
I looked at my teacher in amazement.
"Yes,"
he said.
"It is like when you throw a stone into a pool and the concentric waves spread out further and further. Who knows where it will end? Redeemed humanity is still young. It has hardly come to its full strength. But already there is joy enough in the little finger of a great saint such as yonder lady to waken all the dead things of the universe into life.
While we spoke, the lady, Sarah Green, was steadily advancing towards us, but it was not at us she looked. Following the direction of her eyes, I turned and saw an oddly shaped phantom approaching. Or rather, two phantoms, a great, tall ghost, horribly thin and shaky, who seemed to be leading on a chain another ghost no bigger than an organ grinder's monkey. The taller ghost wore a soft black hat, and he reminded me of something that my memory could not quite recover. Then, when he had come within a few feet of the lady, he spread out his lean, shaky hand flat on his chest with his fingers wide apart and exclaimed in a hollow voice,
"At last!"
All at once I realized what it was that he had put me in mind of. He was like a seedy actor of the old school.
"Darling, at last,"
said the lady. C.S. Lewis here.
"Good heavens,"
thought I.
"Surely she can't."
And then I noticed two things. In the first place, I noticed that the little ghost was not being led by the big one. It was the dwarfish figure that held the chain in its hand, and the theatrical figure that wore the collar around its neck. In the second place, I noticed that the lady was looking solely at the dwarf ghost. She seemed to think it was the dwarf who had addressed her, or else she was deliberately ignoring the other. On the poor dwarf, she turned her eyes. Love shone not from her face only, but from all her limbs, as if it were some liquid in which she had just been bathing. Then, to my dismay, she came nearer. She stooped down and kissed the dwarf. It made one shudder to see her in such close contact with that cold, damp, shrunken thing. But she did not shudder.
"Frank,"
she said,
"before anything else, forgive me for all I ever did wrong."
I looked properly at the dwarf for the first time now. Or perhaps when he received her kiss, he became a little more visible. Beautiful imagery. One could just make out the sort of face he must have had when he was a man. A little oval, freckled face with a weak chin and a tiny wisp of unsuccessful mustache. He gave her a glance, not a full look. He, the dwarf, was watching the tragedian out of the corner of his eyes. Then he gave a jerk to the chain, and it was the tragedian, not he, who answered the lady.
"There, there,"
said the tragedian.
"We'll say no more about it. We all make mistakes."
With the words, there came over his features a ghastly contortion, which I think was meant for an indulgently playful smile.
"We'll say no more,"
he continued.
"It's not myself I'm thinking about, it's you. That is what has been continually on my mind all these years. The thought of you, you here alone, breaking your heart about me."
"But now, you can set..."
said the lady to the dwarf.
"You can set all that aside."
To the dwarf, notice.
"You can set all that aside. Never think like that again. It is all..."
Her beauty brightened so that I could hardly see anything else, and under that sweet compulsion, the dwarf really looked at her for the first time. For a second, I thought he was growing more like a man. He opened his mouth. He himself was going to speak this time. But oh, the disappointment when the words came. "Dwarf,
you missed me?"
he croaked in a small, bleating voice. Yet even then, she was not taken aback. Still, the love and courtesy flowed from her.
"Dear, you will understand about that very soon,"
she said.
"But today..."
What happened next gave me a shock. The dwarf and the tragedian spoke in unison, not to her, but to one another.
"You'll notice..."
they warned one another.
She hasn't answered our question.
I realized then, yes, it's delightful, isn't it? I mean, it's scary, actually. I realized then that they were one person, or rather that both were the remains of what had once been a person. Note that, we'll come back to it. The dwarf again rattled the chain.
You missed me,
said the tragedian to the lady, throwing a dreadful theatrical tremor into his voice.
Dear friend,
said the lady, still attending exclusively to the dwarf,
you may be happy about that and about everything else. Forget all about it forever.
And really, for a moment, I thought the dwarf was going to obey. Partly because the outlines of his face became a little clearer, and partly because the invitation to all joy, singing out of her whole being like a bird's song on an April evening, seemed to me such that no creature could resist it. Then he hesitated, and then, once more, he and his accomplice spoke in unison.
Of course, it would be rather fine and magnanimous not to press the point,
they said to one another.
But can we be sure she'd notice? We've done these things before. There was a time we let her have the last stamp in the house to write to her mother and said nothing of it, although she had known we wanted to write a letter ourselves. We thought she'd remember and see how unselfish we'd been. But she never did. And there was the time. Oh, lots and lots of times.
So the dwarf gave a shake to the chain and...
I can't forget it,
cried the tragedian.
And I won't forget it either. I could forgive them all they've done to me, but for your miseries.
Oh, don't you understand?
Said the lady.
There are no miseries here.
Mean to say?
Answered the dwarf, as if this new idea had made him quite forget the tragedian for a moment. Do you mean to say
you've been happy?
If you want me to be? But no matter. Want it now, or don't think about it at all.
The dwarf blinked at her. One could see an unheard-of idea trying to enter his little mind. One could see even that there was for him some sweetness in it. For a second, he almost let the chain go. Then, as if it were his lifeline, he clutched it once more.
Look here, we've got to face this.
He was using his manly, bullying tone this time, the one for bringing women to their senses.
Darling,
said the lady to the dwarf.
There's nothing to face. You don't want me to have been miserable for misery's sake. You only think I must have been I loved you. But if you only weep, you'll see that isn't so.
Love,
said the tragedian, striking his forehead with his hand, then a few notes deeper.
Love, do you not know the meaning of the word?
Oh, should I not?
Said the lady.
I am in love. In love, you understand? Yes, now I love truly.
You mean?
Said the tragedian.
You mean you did not love me truly in the old days?
Only in a poor sort of way,
she answered.
I have asked you to forgive me. There was a little real love in it, but what we called love down there was mostly the craving to be loved. In the main, I loved you for my own sake, because I needed you.
And now,
said the tragedian with a hackneyed gesture of despair.
Now you need me no more.
But of course not.
Said the lady, and her smile made me wonder how both the phantoms could refrain from crying out with joy.
What needs could I have?
She said.
Now that I have all, I am full now, not empty. I am in love himself, in love himself, not lonely, strong, not weak. You shall be the same. Come and see. We shall have no need for one another now. We can begin to love truly.
Powerful. But the tragedian was still striking attitudes.
She needs me no more.
No more. No more.
He said in a choking voice to no one in particular.
Would to God.
He continued, but was now pronouncing it good.
Would to good I had seen her lying dead at my feet before I heard these words. Lying dead at my feet. Lying dead at my feet.
I do not know how long the creature intended to go on repeating the phrase, for the lady put an end to that.
Frank, Frank.
She cried in a voice that made the whole wood ring.
Look at me, look at me. What are you doing with that great ugly doll? Let go of the chain, send it away. It is you I want. Don't you see that? What nonsense it's talking?
Merriment danced in her eyes. She was sharing a joke with the dwarf right over the head of the tragedian. Something not at all unlike a smile struggled to appear on the dwarf's face, for he was looking at her now. Her laughter was past his first defenses. He was struggling hard to keep it out, but already with imperfect success. Against his will, he was growing a little bigger.
Oh, you great goose,
said she.
What is the good of talking like that here? You know as well as I do that you did see me lying dead years and years ago. Not at your feet, of course, but on a bed in a nursing home. A very good nursing home it was, too. Matron would never have dreamed of leaving bodies lying about the floor. It's ridiculous for that doll to try to be impressive about death here. It just won't work.
I do not know that I ever saw anything more terrible than the struggle of that dwarf against joy. Think about the concept. We'll come back to it. For he hung. Somewhere incalculable ages ago, there must have been gleams of humor and reason in him. For one moment, while she looked at him in her love and mirth, he saw the absurdity of the tragedian. For one moment, he did not at all misunderstand her laughter. He, too, must once have known that no people find each other more absurd than lovers. Beautiful phrase. But the light that reached him against his will. This was not the meeting he had pictured. He would not accept it. Once more, he clutched at his death line. Notice it changed from a lifeline to a death line. Once more, he clutched at the death line, and at once the tragedian spoke.
You dare to laugh at it?
It stormed.
To my face? And this is my reward? Very well. It is fortunate that you give yourself no concern about my fate. Otherwise, you might be sorry afterwards to think that you had driven me back to hell. What? You think I'd stay now? Thank you. I believe I'm fairly quick at recognizing where I'm not wanted. Not needed was the exact expression, if I remember rightly.
From this time on, the dwarf never spoke again. But the lady still addressed it.
Dear, no one sends you that. Here is our joy. Everything makes you stay.
But the dwarf was growing smaller even while she spoke.
Yes,
said the tragedian.
On terms you might offer to a dog. I happen to have some self-respect left, and I see that my going will make no difference to you. It is nothing to you that I go back to the cold and the gloom, the lonely, lonely streets.
Don't, Frank, said the lady. Don't let it talk like that.
But the notice she's still talking to Frank. Don't let it about the tragedian talk like it. But the dwarf was now so small that she had dropped on her knees to speak to it. The tragedian caught her words greedily as a dog catches a bone.
Ah, you can't bear to hear it.
He shouted with miserable triumph.
That was always the way. You must be sheltered. Grim realities must be kept out of your sight. You who can be happy without me, forgetting me. You don't want even to hear of my suffering. You say, don't tell you. don't make you unhappy. Don't break in on your sheltered, self-centered little heaven. And this is the reward.
She stooped still lower to speak to the dwarf, which was now a figure no bigger than a kitten hanging on to the end of the chain with his feet off the ground.
That was why I said don't.
She answered.
Stop acting. It's no good. He is killing you. Let go of that chain, even now.
Acting?
Screamed the tragedian.
What do you mean?
The dwarf was now so small that I could not distinguish him from the chain to which he was clinging. Beautiful imagery. And now, for the first time, I could not be certain whether the lady was addressing him or the tragedian.
Quick,
she said.
There is still time. Stop it. Stop it at once.
Stop what?
Using pity, other people's pity, in the wrong way. We have all done it on an event on earth. You know, pity was meant to be a spur that drives joy to help misery. But it can be used the wrong way. It can be used for a kind of blackmailing. Those who choose misery can hold joy up to ransom by pity. You see, I know now. Even as a child you did, instead of saying you were sorry, you went and sulked in the attic. Because you knew that sooner or later one of your sisters would say, I can't bear to think of him sitting up there all alone crying. You used your pity to blackmail them, and they gave in the end. And afterwards, when we were married, oh, it doesn't matter, if only you will stop it.
And that,
said the tragedian,
that is all you have understood of me, after all those years.
I don't know what had become of the dwarf ghost by now. Perhaps it was climbing up the chain like an insect. Perhaps it was somehow absorbed into the chain.
No, Frank, not here,
said the lady.
Listen to reason. Did you think joy was created to live always under that threat? Always defenseless against those who would rather be miserable than have their self-will crossed? For it was real misery. I know that now. You made yourself really wretched. That you can still do, but you can no longer communicate your wretchedness. Everything becomes more and more itself. Here is joy that cannot be shaken. Our light can swallow up your darkness, but your darkness cannot now infect our light. No, 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 come to us. We will not go to you. Can you really have thought that love and joy would always be at the mercy of frowns and sighs? Did you not know they were stronger than their opposites?
Love? How dare you use that sacred word?
Said the tragedian. At the same moment, he gathered up the chain, which had now for some time been swinging uselessly at his side, and somehow disposed of it. I am not quite sure, but I think he swallowed it. Incredible imagery. Then for the first time, it became clear that the lady saw and addressed him only.
What is Frank?
She said.
And who are you, sir? I never knew you. Perhaps you had better leave me. Or stay if you prefer. If it would help you and if it were possible, I would go down with you if you help. But you cannot bring hell unto me.
You do not love me?
Said the tragedian in a thin, bat-like voice, and he was now very difficult to see.
I cannot love a lie.
Said the lady.
I cannot love the thing which is not. I am in love, and out of it I will not go.
There was no answer. The tragedian had vanished. The lady was alone in that woodland place, and a brown bird went hopping past her, bending with its light feet the grasses I could not bend. We'll stop there and we'll pick up with the actual session next time, the reading of the in the final session tomorrow morning, but we need to spend the final 20 minutes we have trying to at least begin to digest the immensity of what's here. Let's take 10 minutes and talk about what's happening on the human level, and take 10 minutes then to talk about what's happening on the divine human level. What's happening on the human level? Give some just comments or thoughts. What was happening? What was going on? In one sense, it's perfectly obvious, but say it in a way that got home to you.
Well, Frank was continuing to try to manipulate the woman through the old ways, the old earthly ways of pity.
Pity, and in the form of the split personality, what was the manipulation he used? It was acting. It was acting. That's what the tragedian is all about. And if that's not a powerful imagery of what goes on in our lives all the time, I don't know what it is. I mean, it's just fantastic imagery of what goes on. And then do you see what happens when you get to the end? If you elect, and that's been Lewis's point all along, as Fern and I have tried to struggle with, of what's the point of free choice in all of this? If you elect to continue the act long enough, what happens? You're destroyed by the act. You become the act, and eventually you're gone as a human being. Now you try to get to people before that happens, and Lord be praised, some people have gotten to the likes of you and me before that happens too much to us. But that's what's happening. Beautiful imagery, tragic imagery of what happens in a relationship. And all this business of yanking on the chain, of how we play with our own mentalities when we begin to act out relationships and want another person's pity and find the ways we think will draw upon that pity. If you have any sense that doesn't occur, you don't understand human nature. It occurs, and it occurs almost every day. I guarantee you.
And while a person's acting, they're in pain.
Yeah. Oh, right on. Right on.
You don't know how to get out of the pain.
Yeah. Right. Yes. And what on the human level now, what was the lady offering? What was the first thing she comes and says to him? Very first thing.
Don't you want
love? Well, before that even. Yes, before that. Yes, that comes later. What was the first thing?
Forgiveness.
Yes. She says, forgive me for what I've done.
Oh, yeah.
And he can't even see what's going on. He can't see it. He is so far into this split personality, which all of us are into, that he couldn't see it.
Because he also paid attention to the real personality.
Yes. Oh, great affirmation. Right. On the human level, when somebody starts acting, it's so important to try to get through to the human being. Or when we're acting, when I'm acting, thank God my wife tries to reach into the human being rather than put up with all that crap acting that starts going on.
This acting is a cover up for all kinds of other possibilities within the
brain. Yeah, right on. And what did she suggest at the end in his case was a cover up for? What we've been talking about before. Rather than acknowledge he had been wrong, what does he do? He goes and sulks, and he learns very quickly as a child that the best way to get attention is to go and sulk so that somebody in pity will come and say, well, all right, you don't really have to say you're sorry. You can come back and play with us. And he finally ended up doing that with his wife as an adult.
Maybe her sin on earth was she was the enabler.
Yeah, if we take our language today, yeah.
Enabled his pity.
Yeah, and she saw that finally in heaven. She saw that she needed to come and ask for his forgiveness.
Right,
right, exactly. Yeah, she probably spent a fair amount of time on earth enabling the tragedian side of him, rather than shutting the tragedian off and say, as she does in one beautiful place, it's that language that human beings at some point or another find with each other. It's you I want. It's not your act. It's you. You remember the phrase where she says that? It's you I want? Yeah, yeah. And he's so caught up in his act that then he gets caught up immediately again in this further beautiful imagery that she doesn't need him anymore. She doesn't need him. That's the whole point of love. She now loves him freely. She doesn't need him. She acknowledged that it was a craving love, as all of our loves are. This side of death. All of them. And if you think differently, think again.
The imagery of all of these people she helped, all of these animals she helped, was the good part of her kindness.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then the lack of being able to nurture him out of his self-pity was the distortion of that love.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Did you say it's all, that's all the love we have on earth? I question that.
Okay.
Don't we love the Christ in one another too? Can't we love the Christ in one another?
Okay, let's shift to that love and talk about it for the remaining time we've got. Let me suggest, because we have such little time, and we'll pick up on this tomorrow morning again at 10:45, because there's really powerful stuff going on here about what we mean when we pray this prayer. Let me suggest the possibility that this side of heaven, we cannot love without it being need love.
Without it being need love.
Now come back to me, some of you. Maybe some of you are further along the road to sainthood than I've ever known about. I mean that seriously, quite seriously. And maybe you're suggesting something I haven't known. But one of the insights for myself I've learned as I turn the big 5-0 is that, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's one of the things I had to learn. There's not anything wrong in discovering that my needs, that my love is need love. And that's not wrong. But it's in beginning to recognize that then I can begin the little increments of transforming it. Now, some of you come back to me. I mean, that may, you may want to look at that a little differently.
But isn't the Christ, like the Christ love for each other, that is when we serve and when we lose each other, and when we lose ourselves and others, that then the Christ love comes through and we no more hang on to all these material things. They aren't as important.
Yeah, you're right on. And it does happen, but I think it happens rarely and in moments, and we only truly, in my experience, recognize it retrospectively. If you go into any situation thinking that you're going to be the servant and the one who does the loving, you've almost distorted it from the beginning. Be very careful of looking at yourself as the one who's entering into it without any need love. Be very careful of that. It's a very subtle thing that starts to occur in human life and distorts yet one more time, so it's no longer pray, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, but my will be done. I will to be known as the giver. And that's why it's so important when we concentrate here in these days on all the terribly important issues we're talking about. Social justice, Central America, homosexuality, racism, all the other issues we're dealing with. Those are of utmost importance because they are the way in which these things are lived out. But if the inner spirit isn't being renewed in that process, we become hollow people doing these things. And we have to have some sense of what you're pointing to. I think you're exactly right. That as we get some sense, now to pick up on this phrase here, two or three chapters ago, those of you who were here two sessions ago, we know the top line here, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven, was an understanding of what we have, what it means to live in hell. Namely, we will not give up our own will, so we would desire to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. But what you are pointing to is exactly right. The whole point of heaven is service. And if you don't want to serve God, you probably don't want heaven. That's the whole point. And I think you're pointing to that. My point is that on this earth, as long as we're on this earth, we've got to be very careful of the process when we become too self-preoccupied with the service. You can sometimes look back afterwards and say, yes, thank God, service was done in that situation. And you continue on with your duty, with your responsibility.
I'll come back. You were asking some feedback. And my bias is always, again, to look at how this plays out in societies, at the societal level as well as the interpersonal level. I find that message of preaching service to be very dangerous without taking into consideration the power dynamics in any society. Because I think historically it's been used to keep oppressed people or people who've been marginalized in oppressed positions. Women have been taught over and over again it's better to serve than anything else. And that's kept women in service positions. And the same message is preached to African Americans for centuries about how great the reward will be in heaven because they're such good servers here on earth. So I think there's some power in the message, but I think it's really dangerous if you don't analyze what kind of power dynamics are present in society.
Yeah. That's why the prayer is, we pray that it will be done on earth. And I think Dan is right on. That until you have human beings free of the very thing Dan is pointing to, you're going to continually distort relationships. Whether it's in interpersonal relationships between parents and children, siblings, husband and wife, or in the larger macro issues of society, you're always going to have people subverting the process if they don't have some understanding of what it means to be freed from their own will and need to serve or need to love and recognize that that's what's going on. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yes.
Another way to say it is to be able to love without expectation of anything in return.
Thank you for bringing that up. Let me push back on it if you don't mind. My sense is that happens very rarely on this earth. I don't think that happens. Even when Jesus says, what's the greatest commandment? You shall, no greater love has any person than what?
Lay down
your life. Okay. Now, we all know the terribleness of living around somebody who adopts that and wears it across them like a big emblem and become martyrs, right? The martyr complex.
Yeah, because you're saying that you lay down your life for someone else, whereas it's you lay down your life for another life.
Yeah, right on. Exactly. And so in this earth, it's extremely difficult to get your self-interest out of the way. And the more quickly we recognize that, I think we'll have a greater understanding of what it means to pray this prayer. And the beautiful, beautiful story, again, straight out of the Old Testament, this stuff is as old as the ages. You shall love your neighbor as yourself.
Can't love your neighbor until you love yourself.
You can't love yourself until you love your neighbor. Yeah, it's a mystery. It really is. And I think what C.S. Lewis is saying here, now, and Dan is right to pick up the macro part of it, but now let's move to the divine-human relationship. You cannot rule God. But that's what we constantly try to do. Trying to be said here in this particular story. There was the effort to rule, want things done my way. You cannot rule God. In this sense, service or servanthood is the entirely appropriate role to learn the servant role. And it so quickly gets distorted, as we've all pointed out. Well, the man, the husband in this story, was a beautiful example of distorting it. I mean, he thought he was serving his wife. All he was indulging his own selfishness the whole time. And in the heaven-hell dynamic, until he could learn how distorted he was going to get wrapped up and was going to choose hell. Some of you, I have not lived directly with it unless you expand out. Some of you who may have lived with either addiction for yourself or addiction in others, and particularly as this whole 12-step process gets broadened out to include so many other addictions, we'll know some of it. That's the downside of it. Yeah. But there, oh, that can also have a very positive side of just on that. Yeah, too. Yeah. But that's the whole point here. If all you see in this life is the need to aggrandize yourself, this life is the entryway into hell. If you begin to see that your true life is in being reborn, being resurrected, in the classic Christian language, baptized, or the language we talked about yesterday in Paul, born mortal, reborn spiritual or immortal. That I know it's so hard to conceive of this when we get, as we all should, get wrapped up in the day-to-day life issues, in the immediacy of all the tragedy and suffering going on in the world, that we are born for heaven. And this life isn't all there is to it. just as in the analogy we used yesterday, that the caterpillar on a leaf seeing a butterfly go by has no way to know that that's eternal life. It's so difficult for us to conceive that there's so much beyond. You get a little bit of sense of it if you walk around with Joe. He just came in a few minutes ago. Walk around with Joe on some of his walks, and you get some sense of what the immensity of life and nature and astronomy is all about, and you begin to get some little more humbled sense of what it's like to be a servant in this whole process. Joe, I think, and I haven't talked to him that much, but sees himself as a servant of that process. Rather beautiful one, in my opinion. You didn't need the accolades, Joe, but you got them. Yeah.
Will you be fine?
Probably not. Yeah, probably not. Somebody else give it a try. I could throw out a couple thoughts.
What made me ask the question was Dan bringing up the abuse of servitude. And I take the meaning of serving in heaven to have an entirely different meaning than waiting on God. My sense is to serve God is to pay attention to what he has to say and then do it.
Yes. Well, let me suggest a couple other images. Somewhere down inside every single one of us, we long for joy. And you soon begin to discover that the only joy that's worth anything at all is in service. So that's one image I'd lift up. Service is joy. Let me lift up another image. Just change the word around and say love. Change the word again around and say repentance. Service is repentance. What was the service that the lady offered to her husband when she first sees him? I ask you to forgive me. That's sometimes the greatest service you can offer another person. Transform that to the theological level. What's the greatest service we can offer to God? God, I ask you to forgive me. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. That person went home justified. Those are perhaps some alternate images of service that perhaps can free us up from what Dan is talking about.
I think the word free is part of that. When I see the word serve in that context, it's the freedom that I have to serve. When I see the word service in the context that Dan was talking about, it's the requirement to serve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right on. Yep. I'm glad you asked the question because it's opening up several things on mine. The other thing we need to learn is to let ourselves be served by God. And I think that's part of the transforming of the imagery.
That concept of forgiveness is service.
Yeah, so same point.
Not only forgiving others, but forgiving ourselves allowing God to forgive us.
Yes. Now, in the couple minutes we had left, and before we go to some of the wider stuff in the session tomorrow, say some things back here with each other about what does it mean that pity is used as a tool. Notice how at the end this got lifted up. Pity got used as a tool. Do you have any sense from your own experience of what they were getting at there? Yeah. Page 117, middle of the page. It's almost like the dwarf is already gone, but the lady cries out still, saying, quick, she says, there's still time. Stop, stop, stop. And he says, stop what? Still doesn't know. Using pity, using other people's pity in the wrong way. We've all done it, have been on earth, you know. Pity was meant to be a spur that drives joy to help misery. Now there's a phrase worth holding on to. That's pity turned from subversion and resurrected. Pity was meant to be a spur that drives joy to help misery. Great line. But what do we use pity as? We try to gain somebody else's affections, attention, by appealing to their pity. And that's subversion. That's manipulation.
So we use it for control.
Control.
Really? I mean, that's really what we're trying to do if we use it.
Yeah. Okay. We need to stop. Tomorrow what we'll pick up on is how that exactly works in relationship to God and why the concepts of hell and heaven are so crucial. Hold on to that if this stuff appeals to you. And we'll talk about how we use pity in relationship to God and why understanding that whole process is so important in relationship to the whole business of heaven and hell. Good. Thanks for your readings. Good reading.
Thank you.